Welcome to Highway Diary. I'm your host, Eric Hollerbach. With me, Jackie Cation.
Hello.
I just was on the Dork Forest, so check out that episode.
Podcast on podcast crime.
Oh, let's my gosh. We went down the rabbit hole. I was talking about Jesuit agents. It got weird.
It got nice. We also talked about improv. We talked about whose line is it anyway.
So, now I've heard a bunch of podcasts of that you were on. I've heard the Dark Forest,
obviously. Have you been calling through my podcast appearances?
I've been, you have this rule that you brought up that every time you're mean to somebody, you have to apologize.
Yes.
So how did when did that get started for you? You were like,
probably 10 years ago. So I'm like 43, 45 years old. And a friend of mine, I told her what I'd been rude. I'd been horribly rude to somebody. And she was like, you realize that is not okay. You are a grown adult person. And you have to apologize. You have to sort of do like a living amends, you know, where you have to admit your part of the... And she's like, and I'll tell you something. If you apologize... And it's funny because I would call her and I would admit that I had done something horrible. And like the third or fourth time she said to me, my friend Liz, she's like, you ever going to get sick of apologizing to strangers? Is that ever going to happen? You know how you're going to not have to do it? Is if you're not an asshat from the get-go. And then you won't have to apologize. And so what it has done is it's bled off 85% of me being rude to people at Starbucks, to people in line. If I decide to be rude, it is a conscious decision of me going, no, I have had it.
Yeah, and as kind of a comic, you have to realize that you have almost a superpower where no one can possibly out-heckle you on the street.
It's going to be...
So it's kind of like, you have that,
and you can say the meanest powers. Thing.
Yeah.
My mother died 2 years ago, and my dad and I were hanging out about 2 months ago, a month and a half ago, and he said, hey, is Mother's Day coming up? And he said, you don't need to know. So, what happened there when my father, who is very thoughtless, that was him actually being thoughtful. He had brought up something that I didn't need to know that Mother's Day was coming up because my mother had died. And it was my stepmother of many years. And he just doesn't have any social skills. So he didn't, he was trying to backpedal, right? You don't need to know. Sorry, I brought it up is what he meant to say. I, on the other hand, because it was my stepmother and my biological mother is also dead. I said, yeah, you're hard on my mother's. That was me actually being mean in the moment because I knew what I was doing as I said it, you know, and I shouldn't have said it because it was jackassery. There's no reason, reason for it. And, but he doesn't. He doesn't have, you know, and the thing is you'd think he would because he's 75 years old. That he would have some sort of filter. He does not. He is not
at Sterling. Those filters go away when they're old. They don't give a fuck anymore.
My father has never given a fuck.
He's any consistent, possible filter would have...
Consistent to the end. God love him.
God by then.
Yeah. So what happens is I get into a bad situation. And what if I do something rude... I just have to apologize immediately.
But that's a good friend to tell you that. I mean, a lot of people, like, let their friends become assholes. I think that that's a culture of L.A. versus New York, is if in growing up in Jersey, if one of my friends is being an asshole, I'll let them know real fast.
Real quick.
Here,
right away.
Here, nobody tells anybody anything because they don't want to upset anyone in case they're a producer of a project later, and so...
I don't know. I don't think it's that well thought out. I think that there's a passive-aggressive... upbringing of because it's I'm from Wisconsin,
right?
And I've always thought of Wisconsin as a place where we're nice to you until you are rude, and then we're rude back. And that is, it's everyone's like, you're such a nice person. I'm like, I am nice until I am not nice, until you have for some reason been rude to me, and then I am rude back to you. And there's no, and but I lived in Minneapolis for about 7 years, and that is more this, what I consider an LA mentality of, no, it'll be fine. And they're like, it actually isn't fine, whatever is happening there. But for some reason, you're glossing over it, and you're like, gonna just eat that resentment, and it's gonna come out in some weird sideways, you know, where you get your face turned into a Muppet. It's I don't understand, but it is weird. I don't know why. And it is regional.
Yeah, there's like a cultural thing. Maybe it's just everyone's just like, I just let them do whatever I want. It's what you're doing is kind of bumming me out, but I'm just gonna walk away. Let's just let everyone. I can't have negativity in my life, man.
I'll
just stop returning your texts and then never directly confront the issue of what is actually on my mind.
I'm better with confrontation. I don't like it. People are like, you're so good at confrontation. I was like, yeah, but I don't know anyone who's... I'm only good at it because I'm willing to be willing to have a conversation.
Just be the first person to be like, look,
I don't want to have this conversation, but someone has to have this conversation. Yeah. And I'm part of the village that is raising the rest of the world because I'm a bit bossy. I'm a fucking bossy magoo. There's nothing
Well, it's just like there's a hypervigilance that comes with being a comic. You just see everything. You see everything that could be better, you know? You see a parent being a crappy parent and then being like, ugh, that kid's gonna, you know, get in road rage with me later on, you know?
I don't need it.
You went to the troops, you did a little USO action.
Sure, it was Armed Forces Entertainment, doesn't pay as well. But it is also...
You got a stipend?
I got a stipend, and you end up going into less safe areas. Even though all areas, when you perform for the troops, the last, and I mean the very last thing that the U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marines wants, is for any entertainment to get hurt. Right. So there was a veritable army of Halliburton around me at all times in Iraq.
Really?
Six guys.
Uh-huh.
Where you're like, we are so far from anyone. I mean, and then it was, because the first member of the entertainment field that dies on one of these tours,
right,
there can be no more tours.
Right.
So they protect you with a weird human shield.
All those people could be discharged who are in charge of the security or something like that.
Well, I'm sure that the situation. Oh yeah, they will get in some serious trouble too. But none of them were army. They were all private.
Do you feel weird about that when you were over there? Why are all these private mercenaries out here doing things just for less congressional oversight or something like that?
Oh, the money they were making. I mean, it was clear. I mean, you, as a conspiracy theorist.
I don't know anything about this. Okay, let's go down the rabbit hole.
But what the deal is, I mean, the money that was being shelled out in Iraq for... And all the guys... and they were all men. But all the guys that we worked with, they were all they had been in the service, and then they got mustered out, and then they were like, wait, so I was making $27,000 a year as a sniper, but now I can make $300,000 just for 5 months? Okay, I guess I'll go do that.
And you can't blame those people, but it's what's going on here?
It's hard not to take that check, but do you ever see the movie Dave? Kevin Klein.
No, I don't think I saw him.
Might have been Sigourney Weaver, Kevin Klein, and he plays essentially the president dies, and he is a lookalike, and they put him in, and he has Charles Grodin come in and look over the national budget, and Charles Grodin's like, if I ran my business like this, and they would put me in jail, and he's doing like line veto through the budget, and he's fixing it, But I'll tell you something. I knew nothing going over to perform for the troops. I don't know anything. My father was in the Marines, but it was all a terrible accident and a terrible mistake. And my father...
Was he in Vietnam?
No. That's why he left. Because Vietnam was happening. And he was like, look over there. And then I gotta go.
He went to Canada or something?
No, he didn't. He had been in for 6 years. And in 1960, he heard about guys going to Vietnam and not coming back.
Right.
And so he was a medic. He wasn't in the Marines. He was in the Navy, which the Marines is part of the Navy. And so they get their medics from the Navy. And as my father likes to say, did you know that the Marines get their medics from the Navy? I didn't. And so I spent 6 years hanging out with Marines. He was like, I would have made the worst Marine ever. And so when Vietnam happened, he said, there's not a chance in the world I'm going to Vietnam with a giant red X on my forehead so they can kill me. And so, as he has often said, I would rather be called a coward than an idiot. And so he didn't go. And so I come from a long line of runners. We don't fight.
I think that's very virtuous.
Well, it turns out we're survivors. And so so when they asked me to go to Iraq, I was like, yeah, like, because I'm against war. Right. I'm always going to be against it. I'm against hitting. Do you know why I'm against hitting? Because people used to hit me.
Yeah.
And as a hittee, could always be against hitting. And so so I go to Iraq, and everyone I meet in Iraq in the service, I learned more about the troops than they learned about... I mean, I hoped I entertained them, but what I learned was that 98 or 99.9% of the people that I met when I went over there, and I went over twice, they were genuinely people who had joined the armed forces to be of service. They were like, you know what, I want to help somebody. I think that I could... And they want to get out of their little town as well, but I mean, or whatever. But... there was 1%, less than 1%, I would meet these guys who were like, I'm winning the war by myself over here. You're only safe when you're standing next to me. You want to feel my muscle? Let's do this. And the guy standing next to that guy, or that woman, because sometimes it was women, were like, no, she's fine. He's fine. They're assholes. But don't worry about Bill. Don't worry about him. Just stand by me. And I mean, they even knew that he was a Maroon.
Right.
But 99% of these people were perfectly hardworking. And then the other thing I learned was that it was a job. Right. I'd heard that it was an adventure. Turns out it is a job, much like everyone's job, where you end up doing shit you didn't want to do because that's you're working. You're at work. And they're like, no, you have to go do that thing. And you're like, I don't want to do that thing. And they're like, well, it turns out you're clocked in. So you got to go do that thing. And you're like, fuck. And you go do the thing because you're at work. And that was the biggest, because I tell the story on my new album, but we were lost in this mine-resistant armored personnel vehicle. There's three of us, these MRAPs.
It's resistant, but is it really going to stop
one? Everybody kept telling me, they said, no one's ever been killed in an MRAP, Jackie. No one's ever been killed in an MRAP. And I said, has anyone ever wet themselves in an MRAP? Because that's what I'm going to do.
I'm going to break that record.
Yeah, so it came to pass. But so we drive, and we're lost, and we're all on headphones. And my first sign that it's a job, because in this MRAP, there's a guy driving. There's a guy navigating. There's a kid sticking out the blowhole with a ba-da-da-da, right? And there's a kid next to me with a giant rifle. And then two comics, because that's what you want in an MRAP. A couple of comedians. And so we're driving through Iraq. There's three of us in a row. And we get lost. And my first sign that it's a job is the sergeant gets on the horn and he starts yelling at the navigator like everybody's job. If you've ever worked in a restaurant.
Right.
And sometimes someone will throw up in the bathroom. And the manager will come out. And everyone will freeze. And then he'll pick someone. And then that person will go, fuck! And they will grab their mop and go clean up the bathroom. So we get lost, and he says, someone has to get out of this truck and direct us over this dirt bridge, or we're going to tip over. And everybody froze. Mm. And then he goes, Munoz, it has to be you. He was the only guy with a door. He was the navigator guy. And he goes, fuck! And he grabs his rifle, and he actually said, that's where the bad guys are. And then he gets out, and I was like, oh, it's a job.
Yeah.
It was the biggest revolution.
But also, you know, they're just people following orders. You know, you got to be damn sure the people sending people over there know what the hell they're doing.
They do not. They do. Of course. There's no hitting in grown-up land, folks. That is the rule. That is the last time you are allowed to hit someone, punch someone, think about killing someone, is when you are approximately 15 or 16 years old. That's about it.
Yeah.
And then after that, they will prosecute you. And you're supposed to kind of really get your shit together.
Yeah.
Calm down.
There's such a difference between, let me understand. It's illegal for me to punch someone in the face on the street, but you can get a drone and you can put infrared radar on it and you can.
But that's the government.
You can
vaporize. That's not an individual.
Yeah, but it's just unbelievable. What's going on?
It is not fair. It is not just. It isn't even anything to do with our Constitution.
No.
There's people incarcerated for the last 13 years in Cuba on property we shouldn't own.
Right.
And a sovereign nation that we should not be part of.
Just because it's like a legal loophole for the CIA to do whatever.
It's essentially a giant looming dirtbag looming over you going, I'm going to eat your lunch.
Yeah.
And you going, I guess you're going to eat my lunch. That's what Cuba does. And then we have, 100 people stashed away in tiny cubicles who used to be 17, and now they're 30. So, great.
But it's like they can't even remember what their trial's about. They've been in Guantanamo Bay being tortured for most of their lives at this point.
There's been no trials.
You had you did a show called The Risk a couple times. One of those shows,
Kevin
we're going to bring
Allison.
It back.
Oh, essentially, we'll take a tour about the of my internet presence, of my internet footprint. Let's do it. Let's drive through that highway.
But you, let's document that shit. You said you told a really interesting story at risk that you had this kind of like codependent friend with the called Kelly.
Oh right, and my lesbian experience.
Yeah,
you're hello and welcome to my lesbian experience.
Let's talk about it.
It counts. It counts.
So you would make out with her, and then. But then she would be like,
I see where you're going.
She would take guys back to the place, and you'd just be like crying next to the place, like listening to the sex. And then you'd be fighting. And then she'd kind of tear you down and then build you back up. And then you guys would go out in the town again.
Well, she never tore me down. She's not a bad person. I mean, I'd hope that what it was is it was the dumbest non-friendship that I think I'm not alone in having. And it, when booze gets involved,
right,
judgment goes out the fucking door. It's the first thing. And, you know, I've been doing stand-up comedy for probably 4 or 5 years. And she was a more established comic, and she always had a project. And so she was like, I think you're funny. I'm going to make sure that... And I'm a bit of a mess at this time. I'm drunk all the time. I'm funny, but I dress... essentially in my brother's clothes, and I have no social skills.
So you moved from, this is right at college, you were in Minneapolis right after college, and there was a couple years where you were trying stand-up comedy, you weren't...
And I was doing all right, but I mean, it was just, you know, when you start doing stand-up comedy, nobody knows who you are, and nobody cares, and you just keep doing stand-up comedy, and then eventually someone cares, or... they never do. Mm-hmm. One of those two things happens, and then you continue to do stand-up comedy, and nobody ever cares, but you win when you die, because you got to do stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And or someone does care.
Pretty much describe the Comedy Store.
Exactly. It's like, and so it doesn't, and the Laugh Factory that never puts you up puts a thing on their marquee that says, she's making God laugh now. Laugh Factory, never do that to me. If I'm not allowed to perform in your club, please do not have my name on your marquee after I die telling me that I'm making God laugh, because I'm going to haunt you. I will come back to life and fucking zombie your ass. Anyway, but yeah, so whatever. I mean, there's... the comedy part doesn't really matter. Essentially, we would get... She's like a very charismatic, you know, person that you'd go clubbing with, right?
Right.
And guys flocked to her, and she was like, no, you could have a boyfriend, you could have a fella, you could have all these things. And she was always encouraging me that I could have everything I ever wanted in life. We were friends for a couple of years, and then, you know, she would try to get me laid. Because she's like, you need to get laid. Mm-hmm. And then she'd bring an extra guy home, and she's like, no, go do her. Because I'm over here with this guy. And so, I mean, it was genuinely awkward and weird. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't good at it, because I don't have a lot of great... I didn't know how to be a friend. I have friends that are older than from before I met her, from college and from high school. And those are my friends. But I didn't know... because she was so charismatic, you know, like it's in show business. Like when you move to Los Angeles and you meet someone who's so good looking that you actually don't know how to talk to them.
Right.
She was that good looking. Right. And everybody around us was like, oh my God, I want to be there. And so you're like, oh, she likes me. And then you're drunk and she's bored. And she, and this I have a theory about, because we were talking about Scientology on the Dork Forest, which is people are always talking about Tom Cruise and Keanu Reeves and everybody being gay. And very easily, they could be gay, they could be repressed, they could also be famous and have fucked everything. And so now they're like, well, I've never fucked that. Let's see what that's like.
Right.
And so...
because it's so easy for them. It just becomes this weird
thing. That is
thing.
My friend Kelly. My friend Kelly, I think, kissed me because she was like, oh, that person's in front of me. Let's make out with that.
Right.
And so that became... and then so then I invested more into it because I was like... oh, is this what being a best friend is? Is this what being... or am I gay now? What is happening? I don't know what I'm doing. And then it genuinely just got spiraled and got weirder and weirder and weirder until finally she was like, yeah, I might have made a bad choice here. You should move or not be friends anymore. And she didn't do it particularly well.
Right.
Her social skills, clearly, she is not exactly the most
together
human.
Doesn't have good bedside manner.
Yeah, not...
A little too used to dismissing and rejecting everyone around her.
Possibly. Possibly. Moving on to the next
to
pile of
humans.
To freeze
over her heart every time it happens. But, yeah, oh man, why is it that comics are always so, we're so crazy? You know, I have also, like, this weird, like, social anxiety when it comes to, if there's a party and everyone's talking and, like, two people seem to be, you know, monopolizing the conversation, if you're in a circle of five people and two people keep talking, I'll be very scared to pop in. And
okay.
If you pop in once and no one reacts, it's like, ugh, it's going to be another 30 minutes until I try again. But with stand-up,
right.
It's
yeah.
like, no, this person has the floor
yep.
for 7 minutes. It's their turn.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Then
right.
I know it's my turn to talk. I'm not being rude,
yep.
but let me show you. You know what I mean? It's this weird thing.
It is. I mean, that is one of the stand-up comedy saved my life. You know, as far as mm-hmm. I'm concerned, it gave me self-esteem. It gave me a belief in myself that I could do something.
Yeah.
And that I could be heard.
Yeah.
And it was, and it's a solo activity, which, you know, if you're a bit of a loner anyway, you're just like, yes, let's yeah. do this. And then, of course, then the next thing they do, when you move to Los Angeles, they're like, well, we want you to act in an ensemble cast. And you're like, oh, I don't actually know how to do
yeah.
that. I'm actually good solo.
That's why I like, I did all that improv at the beginning. But it really became my religion. We were talking about, like, how
mm-hmm.
culty it is. Because it was kind of the proof that anyone could do anything whenever they wanted. Like, if I want to be a dog from space, boom, I'm a dog from space.
Yeah.
Yip, 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 yip. I try to be the best dog from space possible immediately.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If someone wants to, if someone tries to be an impression and they're all of a sudden the governor in the scene, they're grandma in the scene, they're anything. Anyone is anything at any time.
Right, whatever they want to be.
Yeah, and that
it.
Really expanded my consciousness where it's like, wow, we can all tap into this. This weird, we can play this game where anything's possible.
I genuinely think it would be good for a lot of people just to take it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, there used to be a lot of stigma in taking stand-up classes
right.
in the 80s and 90s, and there still is some people.
I actually took a stand-up class at Gotham.
Okay, yeah, I think there's less stigma in it now, just because people are like, what it mostly does is encourage you to get up on stage.
Right.
And some people need that encouragement to get up on stage.
People need 8 weeks of writing, doing it in front of each other in class.
Some people
writing,
need that.
Critiquing
because,
each other.
Because
yeah.
open mic is free, but it is also intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
If you are intimidated by the fact of you're sitting in a room with a bunch of loners stealing some poor coffee shop's napkins while you write down set lists on it. And then... That's fine. So I came to a realization in sort of the late 90s that I didn't care about stand-up class. I thought that they were a positive thing, or they could be.
Right.
As long as it wasn't somebody telling you what was funny.
Right.
What you could write and what you could not write, or what
mm-hmm.
you should write and what
right.
you should not write.
Right.
Because that is not improv. That is not I want to be a dog from outer space. Write about being a dog from outer space. Be whatever you want to be.
Right.
And if you're
stand-up's
write...
so different because you're not, you have no mask. It's yourself, you
mm-hmm.
know? Or you can play a character like we were talking about in Dark Force, where
yeah.
it's like you can be the Andrew Dice Clay who's playing a character or the Jim Norton who's doing his own life, you know?
Right. But whatever it is, you're definitely, you know, but what you choose to write about, it's like novelists, you know?
Right, yeah.
I mean, it's so clearly autobiographical. You can do whatever you want. That could be said under the sea. But
yeah.
that is your grandmother.
That relationship. Yeah.
That happened in your world.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating how... Because there aren't... You know, there's people who are better at social skills than other people in stand-up. But it's just a row of Asperger's victims fighting a wind of autism.
I am no exception, for sure.
And I am not either.
Did you care so much when you first started doing stand-up that you would, like... Me in level two of Chris Gethard's class, I would cry. And I've cried a couple times with bombing. Then late at night, I'm like, oh, fuck, that sucks. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I wish I did better at stand-up. Did you ever, like, care so much? You know,
every show.
Yeah.
The crazy thing about stand-up is that the only thing that fixes a bad set is a good set. It can fix a bad day. It could fix
oh,
a
yeah.
death in the family.
Uh-huh.
It could fix... the world ending, a good set can fix it. The only thing that fixes a bad set is a good set. A good day, the love of my loved ones does not fix a bad set.
Yeah.
I am sorry, Andy Ashcraft. I love you dearly. You can't fix a bad set. The only thing that can fix it is a good set. And it's, and I've always cared. When I started doing stand-up, it was like heroin. I got a 1.8 that semester. I was allowed to do stand-up 7 nights a week, 5 to 7 minutes a night, for Bill Kinison, Sam Kinison's brother. And he would send comics from here and New York who were willing to work for, and this is supposedly in the golden, remember everyone's always talking about the boom time. It wasn't a boom time in Madison, Wisconsin, where I started. It was where guys who had been doing stand-up for less than 2 years would be allowed to do 45 minutes if they would work for $250 a week plus airfare and a shitty apartment on State Street in Madison, Wisconsin.
Right.
So we hung out with these guys who were like, we're hanging out. One guy was such a tool bag. I can't remember his name, thank God. But he was talking about how he was a Comedy Store comic.
Right.
Comedy Store. You know the Comedy Store, 1985. This is 1985. He's like, it's a Comedy Store. It's a big deal. No, I know. I know Kinison. I know, you know, all these Seinfeld, I don't think was big at that time. But you talk about Letterman and whatever. And he's and we were all just hanging on every word and just wowed and blown away. Yeah. But he was also a giant asshat where he... What one of the other comics...
He's a Comedy Store guy, probably.
Yeah, total Comedy Store guy. And he was just a jackass. Because one of the other comics, one of the young comics, because there were 7 of us who started out together. There's only 2 of us who are still doing stand-up. And a guy named Steve Marmel. Steve Marmel, he's online. He's got a big presence right now, whatever. He worked on the Fairly Odd Parents. He's funny guy. Super dark, very political. And at the time, one of the best of us. Because he had been doing it a couple years longer. And we would play improv at the end of every show, and he nailed some scene. Just nailed it, and it was hilarious. And he did it by sort of taking the punk out of this guy. He just, you know, he just slammed him.
Right.
Just riffing. Well, it's stand-up comedy. There will be ball busting, whether you own balls or not.
Of course.
And so, after the show, Steve goes up to the guy, and he's like, hey... You know, just no hard feelings. I was just screwing around. And he puts out his hand, and the guy had a cigarette in his hand, and he put it out in Steve's hand.
Oh.
Because he was a dick.
Yeah.
And so when I graduated from college, luckily that club burned down. And when I graduated from college, those 6 comics were all moving to Chicago to do stand-up. And so that was such an incestuous, horrible... Because it was not a nurturing environment.
Right.
It was incredibly competitive. And for no reason. We were in Madison. Did I mention? We were in Madison.
That's how UCB is. Level 1, though. It's really competitive. Everyone
for
is
no
like,
reason.
Yeah.
You're like, I don't think you understand.
This class.
It just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And so I moved to Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, you guys are all going to Chicago? Well, see ya. I'm a runner, I'm telling you, much like my father. I'm not going
survivor.
To Vietnam. I'm a survivor. That's it. Yep.
So, also, all my questions are like psychology questions. Just
because
probably I'm just trying to fit. But do you think you struggle for attention with so many siblings? You have so many siblings.
Right.
Do you think that struggling for your parents' attention is a secret reason why you
do stand-up? I was just talking to my siblings this week because... We were raised in an atmosphere of chronic disinterest. They could care less. Hope it all works out. Raise yourselves. And
just go out in the yard and run around. And
Be back by 5. Every minute you're late, you're grounded in a day.
Right.
And so the rules were very strict, but the what you're doing when you're not there, none of their business.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great, except for that I'm 9. And in this story. So
pretty much a feral child.
Right. So we would all sit at dinner, though, the 6 kids and my dad and my stepmom. And you would have about a minute and a half. You'd get like half an open mic to get my father's attention.
Uh-huh.
And so you had to keep it tight. You better have a good story. Have it all loaded in the chamber. And my father would hold court, and it would because he's a salesman, and he's a very funny guy. And, you know, the thing about having 6 siblings, and this is the good news about having 6 siblings, is that you don't have to like all of them. You know, you can be friends with one or two of them, or three of them. I am the only child in my family that speaks to all of my siblings. My oldest brother is an evangelist. My second oldest brother is a Lord of the Rings fan. My third oldest brother is a commodities broker. We're very proud. Everybody's in some sort of money laundering, by the way.
Your sister sponsors the podcast?
My sister does sponsor. She is a financial advisor. Mm-hmm. She's a socially responsible financial advisor, darlocation.com. And she is, my brother Russ is an econ professor. And so they're all older than me. They all get a lot, you know, they're all very successful at what they do. And I think of myself as pretty successful, but nowhere near as successful as them because they're all my older siblings and they get to be more successful. But so I do have, I always, you know, I struggle with all of that nonsense,
of course,
which isn't real. It is a committee meeting going on in my head that I have been invited to against my will.
That's awesome. Every comic who gets booked at a room, it's like, oh, I want to get booked
I bet they're having a better career than I am. Yeah. Like right now, Angelina Jolie, Maleficent is out. And she's sitting around going, well, why did Jennifer Garner get that thing and I didn't get that thing?
Right.
Because there's never an end to it.
Yeah.
The hole in your... Maria Bamford does this joke about how the hole in your soul is never going to be comedy-shaped. It's never going to be filled by comedy. You have to fill it with something else.
Yeah.
Or you have to have a life.
That sociopath CEO was just like, did my neighbor just get a second jet? I need two jets now?
Right. That's it. There's never... I mean, Dick Cheney...
Yeah.
Donald Rumsfeld, they have achieved a new level of evil. But they look around and they think to themselves, but am I as evil as Hitler? Am I achieving
they all the have some painting on their
Stalin?
Wall.
Yeah,
they have some Fuhrer. Some Fuhrer. Or like some Vlad horrible. The Impaler.
Yes. It's like, I am not Dracula enough.
Dick Cheney just looks at Darth Vader. He's like, fuck. I want to shoot the...
Why can't I control people's collars from afar?
Do you know how good that would be to bore me? One of my jokes actually is a bit about Dick Cheney, you know.
For or against? No, I kid.
Well, I say he's, you know, he's got an electric heart. It's true. He got like an electric heart.
A rascal?
Yeah. It's like, it just pumps blood continually.
Oh, electric heart.
Yeah.
I thought you said cart.
No. He's got a... Well, I think he rides around in one of those. He's not very mobile these days. But you know, it's just his pumps his blood continually. So, you know, like when you get a bone there, you know, his is probably just electronically stable. Just
Yeah, he rides around like Baron Harkonnen from Dune. Anyway, that's a Dune joke. I'm here all week, you guys.
I saw that movie. So your mom is actually mentally ill, you know, at 32. She was drunk and lost all her teeth and just pretty much... I've listened to you pour your heart out.
Oh my god! Well, was that one on? Was that on WTF? What the hell was that on?
I think you. This is a couple episodes back on Dark Forest. You were talking about this, but and then so I, do you think?
Why, yeah, because my dead mother, and that's what I like to call her, even though the second one's dead as well, died when I was 7 in a terrible motorcycle accident that I did not cause. We are very proud that she died on a Harley Davidson. We are from Milwaukee. Could you imagine the neighbors? Yes.
If she was on a Yamaha?
Kawasaki? Are you kidding? They would never speak to us. What it is to be shunned in Milwaukee. She didn't have any teeth when she died. She died, she was 33. Age of Christ. Coincidence? Yes.
Brutal.
That's the joke. But yeah, she was brutal. But I think, you know how like people are always like, you know, your parents do the best they can. And I genuinely believe that. And I also believe that sometimes it isn't very good. She wasn't very good at it.
Right.
But the thing is when you think about having 6 children under the age of 10 when I was born,
yeah.
Who is good at that?
Yeah.
Who's good at raising 6 almost entirely by herself? Because my father's thing was, well, I make all the money. I'm going to go over here where there aren't 6 children under the age of 10, which is what I would do if I were allowed, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure my mother would have done if she would have been allowed.
I don't have any kids. It's just like, I can't even imagine. I can't even start to think that, oh yeah, I would have that much time to take care of all that. No.
Which is why by the time I was 7 when she died, it was just feral. It was just we were just loosey-goosey.
But your dad...
We were the Lord of the Flies, man. I mean, we were raising each other, but the infighting was brutal. But we had a real nice Like we prevented. There was a united front, but the infighting was a little grim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But your dad kind of will let you be a rebel. He's like, he told you one time, you can do anything you want to do as long as you get away with it.
Right. As long as you don't get caught. My father, consistent to the end. I was just talking to him and I said, because he's going to have double bypass surgery. And and I'm, you know, everybody, my brother Russ, he's like, you know, it's standard. It's a standard thing. Everybody gets that done. And I was like, still scary. Still scary, Russ.
Right.
And he goes, No, I'm not saying that he shouldn't, you know, be concerned, but, you know, I'm just saying.
You know, every 400,000 miles, you need all those checks. You got to take your ticker out and fight around with it a little bit.
And I just, for Father's Day, I just bought him ice cream of the month. And my sister goes, that seems ambitious. Good for you. Good for you. And she was like, wow, all right. And I said, well, I didn't know he was going in for the surgery before I got it. We're a little dark.
You're playing ahead. You bought all that ice cream up front?
How many months? What did he say the other day that just, I was like, because I was having sort of a, you know, as tender a moment as my family gets. And I said, you know, Dad, one of the greatest things you ever taught me was that I should treat myself right. You know, I shouldn't be frugal with myself. I should make sure that if I want a nice cup of coffee, I should go get myself one. It's not going to hurt anybody. And he goes, and he was, you know, during while I'm saying this, he's going, yeah, yeah, of course. And then at the end of it, he goes, even if it does hurt somebody, do your thing. What do you care? And I was like, consistent to the end.
Even to the sociopathic level.
Even to the level where, yeah, no, cheat on your loved ones. It's not going to kill them. No.
If your neighbor's dog is like making too much noise, just like strangle it.
Yeah,
sleep.
Yeah, leave the gate open.
Get away with it.
You get away with it. The gate's open. You didn't open the gate and shoo the dog out. You just left it open.
Yeah, maybe there was a bagel of poison on it, but that wasn't your fault. Anyone could have put that there.
Yeah, my father doesn't like animals, but let's say for the record that he has never poisoned an animal. let's do it. Because the great thing about my dad is, I will say,
uh-huh,
is that he can be, he's not a thoughtful man, but he is more than willing to admit when he has been, when he's dropped the ball.
Right.
Doesn't mean that he'll fix it. Doesn't mean that he will get any better at it. Because we were, I called him on his birthday a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, I spent the day with your brother Russ. He didn't say happy birthday to me all day long. And I said, hey, Dad, when's Russ's birthday? And there was a pause, and he goes, good point. Point taken.
He's got six kids, you know. That's hard to keep up.
Yeah. It's in May.
Yeah, right. Me and my dad actually have been to, you know, it's tricky. It's tricky, you know, maintaining that, you know, and then they get harder to deal with and stuff. And then you have old resentments that, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you gotta, you have to sit through a lot to have a relationship with somebody who doesn't care. You know, who's sort of over it, right?
Yeah.
And I have. I've put in the time to have these relationships with my stepmother, who essentially just was done. She was like, after my father had an affair and they got divorced. And she was like, nah, I'm done.
There were all these kids that weren't her own.
Right, and she raised them all. And she didn't know. In my grandmother's opinion, she saved our lives. And very possible. And, but it was, I kept calling her. No, everybody else was like, okay, I'm done calling her. She doesn't ever return my calls. She doesn't care.
Right.
And I'd be, you know, once a month, just give her a call. How's it going now? Like some sort of golden retriever that, is just psyched to see like an owner that beats it every time. You're like, oh my God, you're back. Oh, that's right. You beat me. Oh my God, you're back. And so, but I did it. And I got over the hump with most of my relatives who have no social skills, who amazing enough to me, have worse social skills than I do.
Yeah.
You're like, how are you worse at this than I am? Because I am not good.
But you can also, but with stand-up, you know, you can kind of take it in a direction where you have power. But in a group circle, you know, it's hard to break into that circle, you know? So,
I'll tell you.
It's tricky.
One time my dad, he made fun of he used to make fun of my weight a lot. And when I had been doing stand-up for about 5 or 6 years, I said, we're in the car, and he made some crack. And I said, oof. You know, you gotta stop doing that. It hurts my feelings. And he goes, well, you know, I'm just kidding. Well, you hurt feelings. I'm just kidding. And I was like, uh-huh. Anyway, so it hurts my feelings. So if you do it again, I am going to make fun of you. And I do it for a living. and it's going to hurt. And he goes, well, yeah, I'm just kidding. You know, I'm just kidding. And I said, right, I know you're just kidding. What I'm saying is that it isn't funny. Mm-hmm. And if you do right. it again, I'm going to make fun of you and it's going to hurt your feelings. And he goes, all right, all right. And then there's a pause. He goes, I'm just kidding. And I let him have that. But yeah. here's the thing. 15 years, he has not made a crack about my weight.
Yeah. And that's the thing about parents. It's like they'll agree with everything you say, but not to your face. They'll like, they'll take they'll tell your their advice.
Friends. Yeah. And they'll tell their friends how proud of you they are, and, mm-hmm. but not to your face.
Yeah, yeah. My dad's favorite thing to do is, so I heard this comedian on the X-Gam. Mm. They were great. Okay.
My stepmother's favorite comedian, Norm MacDonald.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I do stand-up comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
And she did say, but it, I mean, the thing is I told, I had a therapist for a couple of years, right? And it was, I told her that story about my dad. And she said, okay, let's take a moment and really celebrate the fact that your father heard you. Because I can't tell you how many parents would still make fun of you.
Right.
And not hear you. And I said, oh, he knew I wasn't kidding, that I would make fun of him in a way that would not, that would hurt his feelings. And yeah. she's like, I know, but let's give it to him that he heard you. And I said, I'm willing to give, I'll give it to him, sure.
Yeah, it's always hard. There's, that hole in the soul is never going to be a perfect parent filled, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's always going to be, what could they do better? What could they do better?
Right, they did the best they could, and some of it was good, and some of it was bad.
Yeah, it's hard to know when to complain, too. When to push them and when to give them their due.
Yeah.
When to push them, when to give them their due. With friends, too, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm just doing the LA thing. I'm just doing passive-aggressive thing. I'm just going to turn off my phone for now. But what, so you've been doing this podcast recently, you know, The Dark Forest. This
Since is a 2006.
Newer... Oh, whoa. I didn't know it went that yeah. far back. Wow. Yeah, yeah. You've been deep in the, what is your podcast taught you? Is it therapy for you or is it?
It is not. You know, well, what it is the thing about The Dark Forest is that people are on the show talking about the thing that they love.
Right.
You know, and there's a thousand different dorkdoms. You know, I've had people say to me, it was a Kathy Landman. I'm pretty sure it was Kathy Landman. I keep telling it as her. Could have been anybody. Whatever it was, she said, I would be on, but everyone knits. I'm like, nope. Knitting isn't dorky. Knitting is cool, she said to me. And I right. said, again, nope. Everything is a dorkdom, because the Dork Forest is, it's just dork on dork dialogue. And I am a chameleon dork. So my dorkdoms are, you know, have always lent themselves to science fiction and gaming, video games, and now recently board games and stuff like this. But it's not, but it can be anything. Like Proops has been on twice. Mm-hmm. He talked about the history of baseball and then he talked about ancient history. Mm-hmm. But I've also had like I did a dork expedition to this guy who had a train set in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And he showed me his train set for over 2 hours. I cut it down to like an hour 10. It was a bit of a hostage situation. I love him dearly. And he took me to lunch afterwards. It was very nice. And but he never turned the train on. Choo-choo! Audio. Right. Audio. So he's right. just describing the route that the train would take. Him and six of his retired buddy friends have recreated a freight train run from 1964 in Indiana. They live in Michigan. You're like, but are they bringing gold or frankincense and
you
myrrh?
Turn the thing on? Okay, so it goes through that uh-huh. picnic is a real picnic area.
Right, it's a everything is real. Like yeah. they're getting the, you know, they're doing everything and they do it on the schedule. And you're like, wow, that is some deep dorkdom. And so like the first, from 2006, I think, to 2009, I did it live streamed through mm-hmm. Blog Talk Radio, where it was just a conference call. And I had a co-host, a guy named Joe Wilson, mm-hmm. who now puts out he has a couple of really cool web series. The one's a vampire mob. The mafia, that's a hitman from the mafia who's a vampire. And so he bites his wife because he loves his wife. Uh-huh. And he's like, I'm a hitman, there's going to be plenty of blood. Uh-huh. And then she bites her mother. So then he's living with his mother-in-law, who is played, by the way, by Mrs. Krabappel from from The Simpsons.
Oh.
Yeah, Marsha Wallace, who passed away last year. But Vampire Mom. Anyway, but so Joe was the co-host for the first 2 or 3 years. And then he left, and I did it on Blog Talk for another probably year. And then fans donated, and I bought this beautiful setup that we're talking into. And I've been doing it pre-recorded. And since pre-recording, what I've learned is that I never shut up.
I know. I always cut my podcast down, too. And it's always like, oh, no, the guest is fine. I got to shut up. You know, it's like we're our own worst critics.
Right. You know? Well, and the thing is what I've become a much better interviewer only because I've, in going through the editing, and I don't do a lot of editing, but I do a notes section. So I link things that you've talked about, right? Mm-hmm. And in listening to this, to me interview people, how many times have I had to go, oh, that would have been a great story if I would have just shut the fuck up. Well, never going to hear that story. Fantastic. And so that's the thing that I've learned, is right. to zip it when I'm interviewing.
Yeah, it's tricky. Here, I talk about that. Hold on. How do you avoid like that comic like bitterness that we were talking about before? Like, oh, everyone, that person's doing something, that person's doing something. Is it just staying busy, staying just relentlessly, you know?
It is genuinely the greatest. It's the hardest part, I think, of stand up longevity wise. There's two problems. It's stand up. I mean, it's not fair. You know, I mean, my friend Karen Kilgariff, who has an amazing song about how she would just like, she's been the head writer. She's the head writer on Pete Holmes. She was head writer mm-hmm. on Ellen DeGeneres and on a lot of sitcom stuff. And she's super funny. And one of the lines in the song is how come I just can't be, why can't I have a sitcom? I could be the fat husband and you could just be super hot and shut up. And so, because she's like, you know, there's no, that doesn't, you know, even Roseanne had to have a fatter husband.
Right.
And yet, all their children, very thin, genetically not likely, in other news.
And what are they eating? Where right. their kids eating. Portion themselves properly? They're really terrible food for them?
But there are two things that go on when comics move to Los Angeles. And when you do the road a lot. There's the problem when comics move to Los Angeles is they go, well, I was a really big deal in insert whatever city you're from, right? Dallas, Indianapolis, Portland, wherever. And you're like, I don't want to do these open mics. I don't want to have to reinvent the wheel.
Right.
So sad, too bad. That's the gig.
Yeah.
If you are funny, you will move up quicker. It'll help. You know, it'll always help to be funny.
Sure.
But you have to reintroduce yourself. You have to reprove yourself. No one knows that you destroy in Chicago. Mm-hmm. No one cares.
Mm-hmm.
And you might have some friends who could help you, give you a little bit of a leg up, but it's not, you still have to prove yourself. And so comics who move to Los Angeles and get bitter because they're not further along because they spent 7 years on the road, that is one kind of bitterness, right? They're like, I can't believe I'm doing this open mic. And I'm like, wow, Meltdown Comics is not an open mic. Meltdown Comics is an opportunity. A golden opportunity to sit in front of comedy nerds who want you to do every weird thought you've ever and want you to find the greatest punchline ever. Because comedy fans in Los Angeles are jaded. And sometimes there's a pile of haircuts that'll come out and they'll be like, no, I'm supposed to like comedy, right? And you're like, not you. You shouldn't like comedy because you don't know what you're looking at. Yeah. But I understand.
I am a dork. My discipline is video games. I am into other dorkdoms as well. So that is my discipline.
Right. I mean, so that's a bit.
Those are my credentials for being at Meltdown. What are yours?
Well, and the thing is those guys are, they get every joke because they get your weird, obscure video game joke. But they're also alive in American society, right? They're not programmers. They're not just a pile of haircuts who are finance dudes. They're not middle management, 25-year-old assistants at an agency that are just like, well, no, I'm supposed to go look at comedy. What do I think about that? All right, well, that guy could be a clerk. I don't know. And you're like, no, just shut brain off. Because there are people that watch stand-up comedy and they go, that's great. How can I change it? What can I do with it? And you're like, not broken.
Yeah.
So That's a different group of people. The comics that come and are mad that they're not moving up fast enough. That is a bitterness that comes.
There's so many, like, different flavors of bitterness. There's so
yeah, the two major ones are that one where I'm not moving up fast enough in Los Angeles right. or New York. And then the other one is the road guy who's doing, you know, B and C rooms, making a living 35, 40 weeks a year, making $50,000, $60,000 a year. Mm-hmm. They get to do stand-up comedy, and they're like, yeah, but I came up with Drew Carey. Why right. am I not Drew Carey? And you're right. like, because you're not Drew Carey. It didn't happen.
I think more...
You have to be happy with what you have. And that is a learned skill, and you have to remind yourself every day. Mm-hmm. That's all I do.
Also, it's weird. What I hear sometimes is like, you know, Bert Kreischer went over to Greg Fitzsimmons' place and did his whole act for Greg Fitzsimmons. And then Greg Fitzsimmons gave him notes. I don't think enough comics do stuff like that where they'll just perform for each other. And, you know, Chris Rock did that when he was doing his HBO specials. He had Louis C.K. over and a bunch of... And Nick DiPaolo to watch it and stuff like that. And then
they would do Punch Up or... Yeah, okay, nice. Bamford and I do it all the time.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, when I go on the road with her, we play Joke Machine. And we work on new bits, we work on old bits. One of the most exhausting days... Because the thing about Maria Bamford... And I've said it before. Being best friends with Maria Bamford is like being best friends with Hermione Granger from Harry Potter, where you spend a lot of time working because she loves comedy. And I love comedy, mm-hmm. but the way I do comedy is different from the way she does, and she tends to practice, and she tends to constantly write. For her, you know how Louis C.K. writes a new hour every year? Old jokes to Maria Bamford are 3 months old.
Right.
I want to kill her. Because I'm like, remember that joke from 9 months ago? It's amazing. Could you please do it again? She's like, I'm sick of doing it. Why am I? And I'm like, please don't be sick of doing that because I want to hear that joke again because it's fucking awesome. Yeah. And you haven't recorded it yet. Right. So please do it. Anyway, but we sat in one of our rooms and did 20-minute chunks at each other for 3 hours. And by the way, that night, stand-up-wise, we had the greatest show. Because we had practiced, we had tightened up everything, we had punched up each other's stuff. And that's what we do. We sit around and we punch up jokes. And to sit around and punch up jokes with Maria Bamford, that is a gift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think more people should be... There seems to be sometimes... What I liked about improv versus stand-up is there was more of like a community culture. And it's a little bit more competitive when you get into the stand-up world. You know what I mean?
It can be. I mean, you're hanging out a lot at the comedy store. And one of the first things I tell people is don't. But but if you can get in with them and you need the stage time and it doesn't kill you.
Right, right, right.
And it doesn't create... Because what... Especially, like, did you ever do the road much?
No.
Okay, because the thing about the road, you do the road for a while. And there's a couple of ways it can go. You can either choose to stay super clean. And then all you talk about, because you're on the road 40 weeks a year, is what you see on television... What you see driving, what you see in other comics. Those are your reference. Or you can go dirty.
Right.
And then all you have is a lot of stories about getting drunk and trying to get laid and whacking off a lot in the room.
Sure.
And those are your two paths. So one of the greatest things, like, because people are like, you got to go on the road, man. You'll never be a great comic unless you go on the road. And other people are like, you got to go to L.A., man. You'll never make it in the business unless you go to L.A., Both of those, or New York, and both of those are true, and both of those give you, like, there are skills on the road. Like, I can do any room. Mm-hmm. I don't want to at this time, thank you. But I can police and live through any set.
Right.
I will not die. It mm-hmm. will be fine.
Right.
There might be pockets of silence. Right. But I will do my time like you're supposed to, and then get the hell off. And then someone can walk me to my car. If it's that kind of gig. But the thing that's great about doing gigs in Los Angeles are those audiences. And New York.
Yeah.
They want to hear whatever weirdo thing you're coming up with. Because they see so much comedy.
Yeah.
It's neat.
Yeah.
We're in a golden age of comedy right now.
For sure. And like podcasting, people can produce themselves. They can put their own albums out on iTunes or whatever.
My special is for the $5 download. Allthingsrecords.com.
This will make an excellent Horcrux.
It's a Harry Potter joke.
Go to jackiecation.com/store. Peruse around. Get a t-shirt.
Yeah, get a shirt, get a
There's an elvish DVD. Language in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
the Dork Forest, there's a Ranger t-shirt, which has dorky things coming out of the forest. They're all made in America, so they run big, because they're made by Americans.
And, yeah, but there's some elvish words, like J.R. Tolkien made a language, much like Star Trek nerds have Vulcanism, Klingon. That Klingon.
Yep.
Vulcanism. That's like their political
sure.
thing.
That's a sure, it happens, it happens.
It's a movement that got squashed. But, yeah, so elvish language is on there. Do you know any elvish? You know a couple words.
Kenya. Kenya is the name of the language that is. It's,
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay.
But your dork discipline is video games.
No, my dorkdom is more, Lord of the Rings. You would think I would have Elvish. I like video games, but I don't play them enough. And especially I don't play, you know, like the big ones. Like I'm not on a headset playing Halo.
Call of Duty or anything like that. What's your games?
Right now I'm playing, more board games than video games, but I am playing two video games. And they're both on my... One's on my iPad, one's on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
One is like middle-aged white lady game called Hidden Criminal or Criminal... And it's a hidden object game, but it's with murder mysteries.
Ooh.
So there's like a bludgeoned, bloody body in the middle of this scene.
Mm.
And they're like, find the umbrella. And there's like six objects on the bottom. There's a deck of cards in this scene. Where is it? How about the victim's body? Did you want me to find the victim's... Yeah, click. And so that hidden whatever criminal thing, and then I'm playing on my iPad. I play some Candy Crush. I'll play that piece of shit, horrible, bejeweled wreck. Anyway, ripoff. Yeah. But I play the hidden thing on Facebook, and I'm playing Middle Management of Justice, fourth time through. It's so great. You are a middle manager, and you are supervising a superhero team. And it's by Double Fine, and it's really, really silly, smart, but like Sims kind of like Candy Crush and the criminal one, the hidden object one,
uh-huh.
They both are finite. Like you can't play them for days and hours.
Right.
You have to reload your energy bar,
sure.
Right?
That's how it could get you to come back because, oh, well, you were gone. Your energy bars fill up, so now you can upgrade all your stuff.
Uh-huh. Middle Management of Justice, it's never ending.
Right.
I've lost work. The first time I played it, I didn't take a phone call, lost a gig at Largo. Very sad. Very sad. Still mad about
it. Was it worth it? Was it worth it?
Yeah, I beat the aliens. It's all working out for me.
Well, we've done an hour.
Good
for
us.
Let me give your stand-up dates. You're going to be June 24th to 26th in Wyoming with Maria Bamford.
I'll open for her in Maria,
June 28th, Meltdown Setlist. That sounds fun.
Yeah, Setlist is great.
You know, no material. Mm-hmm. Blending Worlds, an improv stand-up. July 1st through 3rd, you'll be at Comedy Attack in Bloomington, Indiana.
The Attic. Comedy Attic.
JackieCation.com. Check out her store. Check out my appearance on Dork Forest.
Yeah, and at JackieCation on Twitter.
Boom. This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me over.
Sure.
For having a spread of cashews and...
and chocolate.
And chocolate and brownies. Well, what a pleasure. So, that's been another episode of Highway... Oh, wait. No. I am going to be at the Ice House in Pasadena, July 13th, 2014, Sunday, 7:30 p.m. Check out HereComesGodot.com. It's a web series. Check out, and Theater of the Deranged 2 got sold to Troma. That'll come out on DVD around September. That's it. That's another episode of the Highway Diary in the motherfucker bag. Thanks to my guest, Jack Cation. What? Later.